This episode is presented by The Green Grape.
Welcome to season seven of Why Food Podcast. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
If you're joining us for the first time, Why Food is a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and other interesting people who have switched careers into the food, beverage, and hospitality industry.
And if you're joining us for the second or more time, welcome back. We're very happy to have you. And if you're joining us for the first time, where have you been for the last 7 seasons?
Yeah, you've been missing. Really. Yeah. We're super excited today to kick off our season with the very esteemed Soleil Ho, who is the new restaurant critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. Before that, she was a chef and a prolific writer on food, race, and culture, as well as the co-host of Racist Sandwich Podcast. Thank you so much for being here, Soleil. Is Soleil on the line?
Oh yeah, the music is really loud, so I don't know what.
Can you still hear the music?
Yeah.
Oh.
Can we turn off our music?
We can't hear the music.
We can't hear the music.
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really loud, actually.
Oh, funny. I'm sorry about that.
Okay. Hi.
Hi.
You want to do the intro?
I just did your intro, so hi, Soleil. Thanks for being here today.
I'm sure the intro was wonderful. Thank you.
So I just want to start, first things first, congratulations on your new post at the San Francisco Chronicle. For people who don't know, Soleil is replacing Michael Bauer, who held that position for, what, like 3 decades? So this is a pretty big change.
Yeah, 32 years. So that means he started the job just right before I was born.
And you also just moved across the country from Minneapolis to San Francisco. So also a big life change. Like, how are you feeling? How is everything going? What's been the response so far?
Oh, wow. So this week we had 2 earthquakes in the Bay Area. And it's been raining cats and dogs. And so I feel very unwelcome so far by the climate. But it's been really wonderful. Everyone's so excited and supportive and just really interested in seeing what happens going forward. So am I.
And you've written a lot about race, the intersection of race, food, politics, wealth and income and all of that. And you've kind of mentioned that you want to continue taking that sort of stance and kind of examining those issues through this column that you'll be doing at the SF Chronicle. Can you talk a little bit more about how you're going to approach that?
Yeah. So, of course, it is a newspaper, and so I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not necessarily an editorial writer, mm-hmm. but, you know, knowledge of, like, the racial wealth gap and class disparities and just, like, how society works is going to be part of what informs my approach. It'll be what informs the restaurants I go to, all that kind of good stuff. And so, you know, I think in a city and in a region like the Bay Area, and San Francisco, I think there's so much space to dig into those themes.
Yeah, it seems like the Bay Area and San Francisco proper in particular becomes a really interesting case study for some of those conversations because there's such an extreme disparity in wealth and such segregation in the city. How do you feel like you can weave that into restaurant critique, which is not necessarily the normal format for having those conversations?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, you know, restaurant criticism in 2019, right? And mm-hmm. like, what do we expect? And I think rather than sitting with what has happened before, thinking about new directions and just not worrying too much about what's come before mm-hmm. is going to be my approach. And so, you know, it's one of those sorts of post-objectivity things where, like, acknowledging my subjectivity and at least being clear and transparent about, like, what I'm looking for and what I care about, I think will be really interesting here because, you know, a restaurant critic is a very opinionated person. That's kind of the idea. And my opinions just happen to also include thoughts about, you know, class and race and gender and all of that stuff.
One of the things that I know Mike Bauer faced some, well, I think he faced a lot of critique about various things, but one of the things was where he actually chose to even go eat. Can you talk a little bit about if you're going to change that process or what the process usually is to even find the place that you're going to review? Because it would be impossible for you to review everything in San Francisco.
Right, yeah. So I will possibly be writing some stuff about that, my particular policies for the Chronicle proper. Mm-hmm. But what I can say now in this preliminary stage, since I just started on Monday, is just my approach is my own, and it will be clear, I think, in the coming days, like what that actually means.
You've held a lot of different jobs and different kinds of jobs throughout food and food journalism. Could you walk us through your career, how you went from working in kitchens to working in media?
Yeah, you were a chef, you wrote, you've done a lot of interesting things. There was bugs involved.
Oh my gosh. Right. Yeah, so after I graduated from college in 2009, I went to work on a farm in Minnesota for a season. This was, you know, right on the crest of the recession, and so I was a history major, and I just realized, like, I probably cannot find a job right now. I'm going to try to lay low for a bit. And so I worked at a farm, and from there I moved to the Twin Cities with my then boyfriend, who's now my husband, and the jobs I could find were restaurant jobs. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I started in the restaurant industry, always in the back. I had some short stints in the front as well. I just wanted to know, you know, restaurants have always been a fascination for me. And so actually working at them and understanding how the processes happened, you know, behind the scenes was so illuminating for me. And at the same time, I was interning and writing once in a while for this online food publication called The Heavy Table, which was very much about celebrating the foods and the culinary cultures of the upper Midwest, which was great. And so I started doing a couple reviews here and there for them. And then from there, it's a really windy story. But
that's the best kind.
It always is.
I've had a very on and off relationship with restaurants. And so I thought, like, okay, I'm done. And so after a few years. And so I decided to go to graduate school. And I ended up going to New Orleans to pursue an MFA in creative writing. And then I quit because it was just really frustrating. At the time, Bobby Jindal was the governor, and he was really gutting the humanities program at the public universities there. And so I just didn't feel like there was any longevity to the program. So I dropped out. And then I started working in the French Quarter at a restaurant called Biona as one of the line cooks. And so I was there for a bit. And then, yeah, just kind of dug in real deep into the restaurant world. And from there, I moved to Portland to continue working as a chef. And then from there, my mother asked me to help her out at a restaurant that she was planning on opening in Mexico.
Oh, yes.
And while I was living in Portland, I started The Racist Sandwich, which I'm sure you know about. Mm-hmm. And the whole time I was writing off and on, you know, in the mornings or just when I could squeeze some time in.
How do you
and
think?
So in Mexico, I did the chef thing and the broadcasting and the writing thing all at once. It was intense.
How do you think your work in restaurants influenced or has impacted the way that you write and the way that, like, your relationship with food?
Well, it's sort of like the idea of being a technical writer, right? Like, you write about drills, for instance, mm-hmm. and you've also worked in a factory where you use the drills every day, and you understand, like, what happens when they break down, and, like, you know the smell, and you've, like, your hands are calloused from using that machinery. And when you write about them, you have that intimate knowledge, you know, even if you're not explicitly writing about how to use it in the way that you have, you at least have a bigger picture understanding of where it all fits, that makes sense.
And at what point did the like other aspects, the bigger aspects around whether it's race or food identity politics kind of enter the picture?
Well, I am a woman of color in an industry, mm-hmm. especially when you think about, like, you know, proper restaurant dining outside of fast food. People like me are pretty sparse.
Yeah.
Especially as you move up the ladder.
Yeah.
And I have these, you know, impossible not to see. You observe it and you experience harassment and, you know, microaggressions and racism in the course of your work. And I, you know, I had all this experience, but I didn't know where to put it. you know, at the time, it didn't seem right to talk about it in restaurant reviews or most restaurant or most like food writing. But that's why I started Racist Sandwich, because I had all of these thoughts and all of these feelings, and I wanted to talk to other people about them too. And, you know, what turned out happening was, I think that work ended up validating a lot of people who were in the restaurant world and in the food world who also felt the same and just didn't know anyone else to talk to about them.
How do you find the balance, either from Racist Sandwich or in your new job, the balance between talking about ways that you want restaurants to change and actually changing the industry overall?
Well, I mean, I think talking is the first step, right? Like, you have the conversations, you model the conversations for folks who've never had them before. I do think that the podcast project has changed a lot about food media and writing and the restaurant world, and given people the tools to at least feel like they weren't alone.
Yeah.
And also just the vocabulary to talk about things with empathy and patience and, you know, decentering like white supremacy and patriarchy in those conversations.
And be able to identify things that they might otherwise have thought was quote unquote normal.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the realizations that you arrived at through that process, through the podcast, or the lessons that you learned, things that you thought you knew going in that changed over the course of making the podcast?
Oh, gosh. I think one of the most illuminating things for me was learning about like the industries that I thought were pretty like white dominant, and which are, but actually talking to folks who are, you know, of marginalized identities, who work in those industries, like, you know, coffee and wine, for mm-hmm. instance, and learning about the work they're doing to make it better for the people who come after was amazing. Like, I just had no idea how much was being done, and just, you know, the people who love those industries and what they're trying to do to make them better, I thought that was wonderful to just be able to listen in on.
I've also seen, I think maybe on your Facebook or your Twitter, you have posted sometimes funny, well, funny may be the wrong word, but entertaining hate mail that you've received over the years. What is it like dealing with a delicate topic where some people feel, you know, as we've seen with the recent Gillette ad, it's like you say one thing that's constructive and people get very angry about it. How do you deal with that? And what do you say in response?
Well, I mean, honestly, I don't respond to the the messages that clearly come from a place of bad faith. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who are just like, "Why are you saying that white people can't eat tacos?" And like, that's never been something I've said. So, you know, it's just not worth a response. And so, the people who have questions, you can tell.
Yep.
And I'm more than happy. I'm so responsive via email if people have like legitimate questions that, you know, they just are lost. They don't know who to talk to about them. I love that.
What kinds of questions do you often get?
Often it's just like they ask for basically like, how can I be a better ally? Right. That sort of thing. Or mm-hmm. how do I show up for refugees in my community who have restaurants without impinging on their space? Like those sorts of complicated questions. Yeah.
And what do you say?
And what do you say? Yeah. Those are two answers? Like existential questions right there.
Oh, man. For that particular question, I told that person, essentially, just take it slow and talk to people. You know, if the restaurant doesn't feel like your place to be, I think talk to the people who actually work there and, you know, try to come to an understanding. Because usually, like, you know, people are open to you being in that space. And it's usually just like an interior attitude that you have of feeling unwelcome. Mm-hmm. And that is if you're of the majority culture. I mean, there's a lot of other like ways this can apply to other people. But, you know, just don't impose yourself and your, like, you know, your lack of knowledge on them. You know what I mean? Like, act very open and then they'll follow suit.
I have an existential question that I've always wanted to ask. I mean, we kind of asked, we had Lagaya Sean from the New York Times on the show very early on when we first started and kind of talked about this with her as well. But like, is there's so much discussion around appropriation and then how appropriation versus a respectful cultural exchange. And I think you've seen that in many of the cities, including Portland, definitely San Francisco, New York. Is there a way for a white male chef to cook for profit the food of a different culture respectfully? Like, is that a thing that can happen, or are we just saying that it can happen because we want to believe? Are there any good examples of that out there?
I can't think of examples per se, but I will say that yes, it is possible. And that is taken with the knowledge that the chef does not work alone, right? Mm-hmm. The chef has a team, and the chef has power to dole out as the manager, as the leader of a team. And so, you know, like if you in your work are promoting other people who are like of that culture, or, you know, like who are not like you, and you're not pulling up the ladder behind you after you take that intellectual property, you know, then I think it's fine. You know what I mean? Like if you are enabling other people to benefit materially, and it's not just you who is turning the profit, and that's such a rare case.
Yeah.
But you see it a lot where like you have people who open Mexican restaurants and the entire team is not, you know, is white or, you know, male.
Yeah.
And then you see kind of like the closing of the ranks. That's when it starts to feel like really weird, right? Like, why is that? It's not a coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Something's happening here that is essentially cutting off access to people of Mexican descent. So that sort of thing, you know what I mean?
Portland, for some reason, maybe you can explain this, seems to be kind of the ground zero for these kinds of conversations,
yeah.
Especially around white people traveling to other countries, you know, quote unquote, discovering some technique,
right,
or ingredient or whatever it is.
And then,
is that
a symptom?
Yeah. Why is that? Right. Why is that happening in Portland, I guess? But I think the bigger question is why does that happen in general? Why is there that inclination on the part of chefs, but then also the varied responses from the public?
Well, it's all really interconnected, you know? Who has the luxury of being a traveler, for mm-hmm. instance, instead of being a refugee or an immigrant? You know what I mean? Like, people who travel for leisure purposes, there's like a class thing there too. The people who have access to business loans to open restaurants, like, yep. They tend to have like a lot of access, a lot of networks. And as you kind of like go through sort of the racial hierarchies, the class hierarchies, gender hierarchies, you notice that it is, you know, those chances decrease as you kind of go down the racial hierarchy. In the Bay Area, for instance, a lot of Black chefs who have like lived in Oakland, for instance, or the East Bay, have talked about their difficulty in getting any sort of investment in their businesses.
Mm-hmm.
We know now after the big recession of 2008 that a lot of like loans happen to be really like racially biased.
Yeah.
A lot of the banks had, you know, criteria that were based on race when they talked about like, you know, subprime mortgages and all that stuff. I mean, this is like totally off topic, but you know what I mean? Like,
the
business loan practices are not infallible and they're not objective.
It's crazy. I actually had an experience I still am not sure if it's racism with the bank, but I swear this is related. I did a pop-up a few months ago, and I paid all my staff, and I always pay everyone with Chase Quick Pay. And my staff is a mix of Asians and Hispanic and Black men and women. And only one person's payment got flagged as fraud. And I'll leave it up to the audience to guess who it was. But it was very strange because everyone else, it was also kind of like varying amounts of money because people work different shifts and all that stuff. And only one person's thinking back as like got flagged across the board as fraud. It was very, very mm-hmm. and I was like, what is actually happening at the bank that they know that this person is from a color, like a color background, and can just tell me they just don't think that I would be interacting with this person. So anyway, very strange.
Yeah.
I also have a question about your recent, you said it was an op-ed about Lucky Cricket, which just opened in Minneapolis. For those who are unfamiliar, it's Andrew Zimmern's spot. It's a Chinese spot, and it's kind of come under fire for his comments about saving the Midwest from horseshit. I think it was the word that he used, Chinese restaurants, and you went and actually ate there for Eater and kind of talked about it. But you said it was more of an op-ed than a review. It was your first impression. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, and knowing that you were walking into somewhat of a loaded zone because everybody had eyes on that restaurant at that time?
Sure, yeah. I had originally just planned to go there out of curiosity. and then the editor at Eater got wind of that, and she was like, you need to write something. I was like, all right. So I just wanted to go check it out with some friends and see, you know, what all the fuss was about. That's always kind of like my first way of thinking about those sorts of controversial restaurants. I just like to know, because I think in any zone where, like, there's been a big controversy, like, the air is different, right? The atmosphere is very strange. And so I enjoy that. I'm totally a rubbernecker. and so I went, and, you know, it was just really underwhelming. And it was a really good opportunity, though, to talk about what happened with him and his comments that he made in promoting the restaurant, and think about, you know, what all of these sorts of ideas, like you were saying, about cultural appropriation and attribution and sort of what it means to pull the ladder up behind you, right? And he was doing everything wrong. I mean, he had, like, Asian American folks involved in his project.
Really? Shocking.
Yeah. You know, the chef in charge there now is actually a Bay Area chef. She's Asian American. And at the same time, to say those things and to denigrate, you know, what the places and the people that, like, enabled him to sell dumplings, right? Because now people know what they are, thanks to all of the generations of Asian American restaurateurs who served, you know, not great food.
Sure.
You know, never would I say Panda Express is great. It's not. But we know that.
Yeah.
I think there's an implicit understanding, and we are fine with that because it is, just, you know, it is what it is, right?
Yep.
You know why they exist. So the interesting thing about his comments was that he didn't seem to grasp the point of those restaurants. It wasn't to be artists. It wasn't to, you know, improve the American culinary landscape. It was to pay for your kids' college.
Yep.
And so, of course, they don't care about, like, what was trendy or what was, like, whatever. They just, you know, cooked from the Bible, essentially.
Whatever would sell.
American cuisine. Yeah, yeah. So it was that was interesting. And so, of course, like, when you say stuff like that, of course, people are going to try to hold you to account. And so that's what I did. He talked big. I wanted to see if he actually showed up for the fight, you know, but it was just
the food. Yeah. Was
the check bounced in that regard, for sure.
And what's the response been like to your piece?
Well, to be honest, like, I did not expect so much enthusiasm because I thought I was really fair. I really pulled my punches because I don't like being mean, you know, and that it would have been so easy to be mean about it, right?
Yeah, but then you just look like you're being vindictive. Yep.
Yeah, right. And so, but of course, people kind of cast it as like a burn-a-thon, you know, something extremely like vitriolic. But in, like, both good and bad ways. So I was surprised. But I think it just speaks to kind of the hunger among readers for something that, like, actually, for writers who advocate for their interests and who, like, are actually a little bit woke, you know, I hate to use that word, but, you know, like, because it doesn't mean anything anymore. But, you know, like, writers who understand these bigger picture themes with regard to food.
What do you think about, like, this interesting situation where he has an Asian American chef working there and, you know, who we can't comment exactly on her reasons as to why she's there and why she chose to work with him, or maybe they had a relationship that was fine before he made these comments, but just the kind of the power dynamic that sometimes you have to work for people or work in places that you might not completely believe in their mission, or their mission is actually might be a little bit against your own self-interest, but there's also, you need to make money, you need, it's a good restaurant, or it pays well, or it has, you know, a reputation. Like, how do you navigate that kind of scenario in terms of identity and, like, need for identity and need for just being able to live?
Well, I mean, that's capitalism, right?
Yeah.
I think we all make those compromises, and, you know, just because it maybe the compromise isn't as flashy as whatever happened at Lucky Cricket doesn't mean we don't make them.
I feel like I look back on some of the things, like recipes I've written, I'm like, ooh, shouldn't have written that. I should pull that from the internet altogether.
Yeah. I mean, like, we all make those choices, and I think there's varying levels of choice involved in that as well, you know?
Sully, we're going to take a quick break, a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
This episode is presented by The Green Grape, a family of three businesses on Fulton Street committed to supporting small-scale farms, celebrating seasonality, and delighting our customers. Order local, pasture-raised meats and cheeses to pair with our selection of fine wines and spirits, and we'll deliver it to your door at no extra charge. From great local gifts to providing you all you need for a delicious meal, The Green Grape offers truly special and hard-to-find products created by New York's community of local makers. Support independent grocers and our site to learn more. Visit greengrape.com. That's green with an E. GREENEGRAPE.com.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers working in food. And today we're joined by Sully Ho, who's the brand new restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. So we were just talking before the break about appropriation. Excuse me, I was eating a sandwich during the break. Now I have a sesame seed stuck in my throat. We were just talking about appropriation and the compromises that people make in the restaurant industry. So, earlier you mentioned that you left the restaurant industry and particularly left the back of the house. Could you tell us a little bit more about that decision? What you liked about it and what you didn't?
Oh, man. Yeah. So my last restaurant job was for my mom at her restaurant that she was opening up in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. And so, you know, I was in charge of managing people and recipes and, like, cooking and all that stuff. And at the same time, I was making my podcast, Racist Sandwich and Propaganda, and writing, you know, as much as I could. And so I just didn't have a lot of time, you know, but I wanted to do all of those things because all of those things were just, you know, vocations that I loved so much. And so it was really hard to choose. I felt like I kept being asked to do all of these other things as part of my writing career. And so I just decided, okay, I just got to do it. And of course, it was really hard because how do you say, I got to go to your mom, right?
Yeah. How did you say, I got to go to your mom?
I said, Mom, I think there's too many things I need to do. I can't be at the restaurant anymore. And she understood, at least. Like, she was really happy because it wasn't, like, a bad reason. It was just, like, I have too many opportunities. I need to pursue those opportunities. So she got it. It was fine.
Was food a big part of your childhood? Did your mother own a restaurant when you were a kid?
No, she never did, although she's always wanted to. She raised my sister and I pretty much alone. And one of the kind of pastimes that we had was eating food, you know, eating out at restaurants. It was like, we grew up in New York City. And of course, since she was so busy, oftentimes we would order out for dinner after school. And, you know, that's how we got to taste so many different things because we lived in proximity to so many interesting restaurants.
And so what kind of food does she have at her restaurant now? And why Mexico? Why Puerto Vallarta?
Well, she likes it.
It is a nice town. It's a nice area.
She's found her community there, so she's happy. And she has two restaurants now, but the one that I helped her open was sort of pan-Asian with, like, cocktails. And yeah, it was the kind of food that you couldn't find there at the time. Usually it was, like, Chinese buffet and, like, really bad Mexican sushi.
Which actually brings me to the question of what is, you know, I think there's a lot of angst about people using the word Oriental, and then Asian fusion was kind of like, and then Pan-Asian, like what do you think is the right terminology for, I guess, the Asian foods, the ethnic foods? Like, is there, should we even be calling them ethnic foods?
I definitely will never use those phrase ethnic with regard to food because it just makes no sense, right? Or it just reconfirms like white supremacist ideas of like whiteness being outside of ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's weird. And then, of course, you know, if you have a menu where you have, I think Pan-Asian is the best description of having a menu where you have ramen and yakitori and like, hot pot and you know wonton. I think if that is your menu, that to me that's Pan-Asian. I think it, for me that feels not so loaded.
Is it okay for the restaurant to have so many things, or if they present themselves in a certain way? Like, because I think a lot of times restaurants, for example, like Lucky Cricket, saying that they make Chinese food and having so many different types of Chinese food under one roof was also a little irksome to some people.
Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of like what you promise at the beginning, you know, like if you say that you're a Japanese restaurant and you serve like Korean food, that's like super problematic, right? There's a lot of history and weirdness with that. But I think if you're clear about what you are and what you aim to do, I think that's totally fine.
What are some of your mainstay New York City restaurants? Where what's your nostalgic New York City food?
Well, we'll go there after the show.
I grew up in Williamsburg. So probably all the places I liked don't exist anymore.
Yeah, they're gone.
Hopefully Anna Maria's exists, the pizza place by the Bedford stop.
I don't think so. Doesn't sound
food. It was.
I was just there.
I would order a grandma pie from there like once a week when I was in high school. So, you know, shout out to Anna Maria's if you're still there. Miss you.
Oh, yeah. That area's changed so much. And that's also one of the interesting things about like the good and bads of gentrification. There has been a lot of interesting places that's open, but there's also a lot of places that have been pushed out, which you're seeing a lot of in San Francisco as well. What are your thoughts on, like, is it ultimately a good thing? Like, what's a good way to actually help the neighborhood and have it be quote-unquote nicer without, I guess, you know, taking advantage of the people who've lived there for a long time?
Well, that's a really complicated question, right? Because it's so much outside of individual power. You know, when you choose a place to live or when you choose a place to get coffee or choose a place to eat, like, you are one person. And so, really, I think the best thing you can do, if you care about this stuff, is work for housing advocacy organizations, of which there are so many in the Bay Area and in New York City. You know, throw your lot in with People Power and actually do something with an organization because they're the ones who are going to have the most, you know, impact.
One of the things that we've talked about on and off on the podcast and that we've talked about as being problematic is this idea of food as a connector, right? Like eat someone's food and understand their culture or eat someone's food and empathize with their life story.
Like that just happens.
Right. which I personally find to be really problematic because what happens if you don't like the food, first of all, and then second of all, there's obviously a lot more going on. How do you contextualize that conversation around food as this entry point for understanding other people?
So I talk about that a bit in this essay that I wrote in 2013 called Craving the Other, which is all about gastro diplomacy and sort of the
gastro diplomacy. Good term. Yeah.
And so one of the like points that I make is that I grew up eating Vietnamese food, but there's so much about Vietnam I do not know. Mm-hmm. I do not understand. There's so much about Vietnamese people that I do not understand. And, you know, those are my people. And yet there's so much for me to learn still. And so there's a lot of, I don't know, there are a lot of holes in that. And, you know, like, in a lot of ways, this has sort of evolved, the sentiment has evolved into a very consumerist idea where you just need to eat at a Chinese restaurant and now you understand Chinese people, right? It's very transactional still. There's not actually any sacrifice on your part beyond like the monetary one, right, to, you know, to give yourself to the other person so that you can share something really significant and meaningful. When you kind of keep it to the transactional, when you kind of keep it to just, I will pay you for this experience and then I will go. And then that's the extent of our connection.
Yep.
There really is no connection.
Mm-hmm. It's a little self-congratulatory as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's this whole thing in America, right, about like basically deciding that you, your identity is based in like what you purchase, which is this whole Fight Club-y kind of thing. Like, we don't have to go over it.
Yep.
There's also been this rise, I think connected to that conversation often, is this rise of restaurants with a social mission. So we had Carrie Brody, who's the founder of Emma's Torch, which is a restaurant in Brooklyn that employs and trains refugees. But I mean, there are examples like that popping up across the country. It seems like at a much faster rate than any time previously. And that's also a complicated situation. Often you're asking people to cook food that isn't necessarily theirs, and sometimes that job training is important so that they can work in other kinds of restaurants, and sometimes that can be limiting. I'm just interested in your thoughts on that topic, on this trend of socially impactful restaurants that often seem to be oriented towards putting people into jobs in restaurants, which are ultimately often not super well compensated, and like you said earlier, without lots of opportunities for advancement within the industry.
Yeah, I think what I can say is that I find it inspiring that people still believe that the restaurant industry is a meritocracy, that restaurants are a space for change. And I think, you know, if we lean into that, if we actually try really hard to think about the other ways that can happen, right, as like places where people talk and have conversations and rub up against other people. And I don't know, like, I think, yes, there's a lot of potential, and I think that's really cool. That's the thing that I love about restaurants in that world. But yeah, like what you're saying, you know, I can't speak for any individual program, but sometimes there is a lot more front than actual like material benefit.
How important is the food in those situations? Like, if you, either as a critic or as a chef or as just a regular person who likes to go to restaurants, how important in that kind of experience is the food versus the mission?
Yeah, I mean, it gets kind of sticky, right? When you talk about like actually exchanging money for services, you are paying money for food, but at the same time, if you go to a place like that, you also, there's this implicit acknowledgement that like you are paying for something else, mm-hmm, too. You know, this isn't a perfect analogy, but you know, my grandmother, for instance, she's getting older, she takes a lot of medication, so her taste buds are kind of weird, and so the food that she makes isn't great anymore, but you still show up because,
yep,
there's other reasons why you're there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, millions of people have been wearing Tom's shoes despite them being atrocious for years, so
right.
I do also want to ask the question about kind of like fast. I mean, this is a little selfish because I'm thinking about writing a piece on this, but and you posted a photo of this recently. I think it was Subway that had like the Vietnamese sauce. Like, do you, mm-hmm, think fast food chains and QSR concepts should be held to the same standards as restaurant concepts for taking what is culturally someone else's and profiting off of it? Yes, but at the same time, they never promise to be authentic. So then do they get a free pass?
You know, I don't think they get a free pass, but I think they should be laughed at if they mess up. You know, like I just take it all with humor because it's just ridiculous. And it also is just like case in point of like capitalism at work, and just like completely sanitizing and sterilizing cultural differences. it just makes it silly. Joke.
And so in the last few minutes of the show, we like to do like a rapid fire, more casual series of questions. So we're going to throw a bunch of questions at you, and you should feel free to respond to them as informally as you feel. Jenny's going to kick us off.
Wait, I have a question.
Before we get to the fun part,
I want to also ask about your work with Bugs and
yeah,
and the graphic novel Meal that you co-wrote earlier. It was last year. Oh my God, it's 2019 yet. And you also went to Japan on like a bug exploration mission. Can you just tell us a little bit about what got you excited, how you got into that world?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm always really open to trying anything. And so insects are also no exception to that. And I've eaten insects on occasion. So the beginning of my involvement with Meal came because the illustrator, Blue Delaquanti, had the script, had like, sort of pencils already done for this graphic novel, and they wanted me to consult, essentially, and just, you know, give my perspective. They were hoping to find someone who was really fluent in, like, the ideas of, like, cultural appropriation and food and, like, those big questions that y'all were asking me earlier. And they kept finding my work. And so they reached out to me and I said, yes, I'd love to work on this because it was always one of my dreams. I'm a freak about comics. I love that. So I was really excited. And I hadn't really thought about those ideas in the context of edible insects until I started working on the book. And it was really fascinating. I learned so much and became so interested in that because insects, to me, encapsulate so many of those questions, right? Because they are just kind of the pinnacle of the abject. In the West, you know, we hate them. You know, a lot of people are just, like, terrified of them. And so the idea of actually putting them in your body as food is so fascinating. And, you know, insects, by and large, are consumed by people who live in the tropic zones of the world. Mm-hmm. And those are areas that have been historically exploited really heavily by the rest of the world. And so I think then you have this sort of extra layer of people profiting off of edible insects in the West by making powders, protein shakes, bars, like all that stuff. And of course, like there's a lot of race and class stuff involved with who is opening those businesses and succeeding to some degree. And so, of course, as you can guess, I was just completely fixated and fascinated. And so I got a fellowship through UC Berkeley School of Journalism. And I used the money to go to Japan, to go to a region where people eat wasps and wasp larvae, to talk about those things. And so I produced an audio segment that you may be hearing on the Splendid Table in a couple months.
Oh, we were actually just talking about, not about bugs, but also about the whole trend of CBD recently and how it's been something that has been used for a long time, is suddenly very popular again, and there's a lot of racial tension over people who are sitting in jail over marijuana and people who are now profiting and using it at their leisure in places like San Francisco.
Yeah. It's, you know, that's why food is such a great way to talk about those things, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, we talk about it every week right here. So,
yeah, you talk about it for regularly. So, questions, Ethan?
If you could master a skill overnight, what would it be?
Oh, man. Vietnamese language.
What was your favorite lunch to eat growing up?
Oh, God. A plain bagel, untoasted, with margarine and Doritos.
What?
As a sandwich.
Whose invention was that?
That was mine. I got like a lunch allowance in middle school, and that was my favorite thing to get.
Was the margarine spread on the bagel?
I would do it myself, yes.
There wasn't a bagel place that was assembling margarine and Dorito bagel sandwiches for you?
No, that was my school lunchroom.
Sorry, maybe in the same vein, what's the best meal you've ever had for under, say, $10?
Oh, that's a nice one. Probably the tsukemen at a place called Funji in Tokyo.
Oh, I've been there. It's so good.
What was the meal?
Yep.
Like the ramen noodles that you dip in the separate sauce. It's so good.
What was so good about it?
The sauce, like it's like a really, really condensed like broth. And so it was like jiggly almost, you know, like it's got a very rich texture on your tongue and like every element of it was perfect. And they give you a dollop of like fish powder on top of the broth too, which is incredible.
Yeah. If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Teleportation.
Oh yeah.
Where would you go?
Oh gosh, everywhere.
I guess that's the point of teleportation is just being able to go everywhere.
What food shows do you watch, if any?
Zero.
Yeah. Do you watch any food shows, Ethan?
Me? I just run through old Bourdain episodes. That's my...
And feel sad.
Yeah.
Well. So, like, who do you think is the next Bourdain?
The next Bourdain.
I don't have an answer for that. I don't think there is going to be a next Bourdain. I think it's just... people just are themselves. Hmm. That's a lot to put on somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Soleil, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show, and we are really excited to read your work now that you're at San Francisco Chronicle and follow your chronicling, can I say that, of the San Francisco food scene. Where can our listeners find you and find your work and follow along?
Well, they'll soon be able to find it in the pages of the San Francisco Chronicle. Otherwise, you can find my backlog of work at soleilho.com. Or find me on Twitter at @HOOLEIL.
Great, and we'll include links in the podcast page. Thanks for listening. I'm Ethan Frisch. You can find me via my spice company on Instagram at Burlap and Barrel, Facebook.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey. You can find me at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And you can always find us at YFood at heritageradionetwork.org, on social at YFood Podcast. If you have questions and comments for Soleil, please let us know. And if you have nominations for other guests, please email us.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. When I'm still blind, all the time I don't know why, I don't know.